like Bold Nations?
Yes, or not. So they say whenever you give a talk, make sure you hit the main points twice. So, for the purpose of this talk, I want you to adopt the mindset that you don't believe quantum mechanics, and ask the question: where might it fail, and how might it fail? And so, my experimentalist perspective on this is that we have a quantum system where we are exploring new physical parameter regimes where individual wave packets of rubidium atoms are separated over very large distances compared to, kind of historical parameters approaching a meter. And we're creating entanglement states, which towards the end of the talk I will describe of many atoms, collections of upwards of 1,000, where they're entangled in such a way that, practically speaking, we get improved measurement precision by the phase number uncertainty relation. But from Tesla quantum mechanics perspective, when you reflect on what's happening quantum mechanically, you become amazed that any of this works at all. So, and then ask the question, why does it work and how might it fail? So I understand there have been some atom interferometry talks. I want to, for those kind of not so deep in this field, I want to remind you of the pioneering experiment done by Jürgen Linnick in 1991, where he did sort of the first atom interferometer with metastable helium atoms. And this was his apparatus, oven source of metastable atoms. These illuminate a first slit. The slit at the time was microfabricated, meaning it was somewhat narrow, I think 100 microns or narrower. And that gave rise to, from the parameters of the experiment, if you just believe Schrödinger equation, a set of cylindrically diffracting wave fronts that coherently illuminated two more slits. These two wave fronts overlap on a detection, add before you square, and you get this is the data of showing the crenellation associated with what you would expect from the de Broglie relation. And some things to note, the count rates here are very low. This is counts in a 5-minute interval, and this is basically a scan across the detection plane. Now, why this experiment was significant, wasn't because we didn't believe quantum mechanics at the time, but some notable theorists, namely Schwinger and others, had published analyses back in the days of kind of Stern-Gerlach that said, you can think about the de Broglie wave interference experiments, but don't waste your time trying, because when I calculated, I found out that it's basically going to be impossible for you to stabilize the relative paths of the two interfering arms so that you can get reliable constructive or destructive interference at the detection screen. And so this Linnick experiment was kind of the first experiment that said, maybe let's revisit some of those bold assertions and find if we have systems where that may not be the case. And of course, this was kind of, I think, one of the inflection points for the quantum technologies revolution, that where we sort of understood that we could, by appropriate control of the environment, build quantum systems that did things that we were surprised by. So fast forward to some data out of Stanford University. As Jason already showed you this picture once. We're very proud of this picture. So, but here what we have are two ensembles of atoms. Each one of these peaks is a false color image of about close to a million atoms. And my claim is that each one of the atoms that comprise this picture is in a situation where it's in a coherent superposition between this spatial location and another spatial location 54 centimeters away. Okay, so there to there is about 54 centimeters. The atom is something that's, let's call it on the order of an angstrom. Okay, we have to talk about the de Broglie waves and so on. But it's kind of amazing when you think about flying these atoms apart to the distance, which is nearly 10 to the 10 times the correlated distance between the nucleus and the electron cloud. And then, as I'll describe, we bring these atoms back together, and they actually interfere. All right? And so the perspective is, how the heck can that happen? And how might quantum mechanics not allow that to happen? We know it does happen, so we're constraining certain theories. All right, so Jason showed you this picture. I can skip quickly through it. This is the apparatus. It's a 10-meter tower in the basement of the Varian Physics Building. It's ultra-high vacuum conditions. We create ensemble of atoms at this location. We launch them up. They fall back down on vertical ballistic trajectories. after they've been cooled to very low temperatures on the order of 100 picokelvin, which means that an individual atomic wave packet doesn't spread very much over the nearly 3 seconds of flight time in that apparatus. It spreads out by about 100 microns, which itself is kind of amazing. These things just kind of go up and come down as grains of sand, even though they don't weigh very much. In order to make all this work out, we need good control over the magnetic fields, so get rid of residual force gradients. So we have a triple layer magnetic shield here. And we also need to do things like compensate for Earth rotation rate. In order for the interference to happen, these wave packets have to come back together and overlap. Anything that makes them not overlap is going to wipe out the interference. And so one of the things that is a tall tent pole in all this is rotation of the Earth. As Earth rotates, our measurement axis also rotates. And if you don't accommodate that measurement axis rotation, there's no way that these wave packets overlap and interfere. So we have what we call the rotation compensation system here, which is a mirror at this location, which basically controls the direction of the interrogation axis, as we call it, or the momentum transfer to the atomic wave packets, which is, subsequently separates them, redirects them, and recombines them. OK, so that's the apparatus. And oh, by the way, we use the light pulse interferometry method, which means we exploit momentum exchange between a vertically oriented laser beam and the atomic wave packets to introduce the momentum kicks that serve as beam splitters and mirrors to build this interferometer. And Jason also showed this picture. And so I'll just say that this all amounts to using pulses of light to spatially separate and recombine the wave packets. And in a reference frame where you're kind of co-falling with the atoms, what these lines mean, this is a time and this is position. What's happening is here comes in the center of an initial wave packet, and then which is spreading out very slowly because it's been appropriately prepared via the, quote, cooling. And then a bunch of laser pulses serve to give one of the wave packets momentum with respect to the other wave packet. That momentum is a velocity kick on the order of half a millimeter per second for every two photons we throw at the atoms. You throw enough photons at them coherently, and that corresponds to a velocity recoil of about a meter per second, so a half meter per second. So you wait a second, and this wave packet drifts apart from this wave packet by its half meter. At this point here, we can throw caution to the wind and take that picture or that mosaic of shots that I showed you previously, showing the wave packets separated by a half a meter. Of course, when we do that, we obliterate the coherence, so we can't see them interfere. But if I choose not to take that picture and appropriately design the apparatus so there's no demon in there kind of looking at the atom, monitoring where it is, then I can bring the atoms back together with appropriate laser pulses. Eventually, there's a final beam splitting pulse, and then I have two output ports. And I can look at those output ports by sort of taking a picture of where the atoms are with resonance fluorescence to learn whether or not I have interference. And so this is a picture Jason also showed. Here we are showing manifestations of interference as the wave packets have been brought back together after having been separated by a half meter at this location. So this is these are now what's in the image plane of our CCD camera. As they've fallen back to the bottom of the apparatus, we flash on a beam of light, and where there are atoms, I see these peaks. Now, how would interference manifest itself? Well, it would manifest itself just like in an optical interferometer, the probability of detecting an atom in a given position of output port of the interferometer. And so, for example, if you've aligned this device so that there's a pi phase shift between the two interfering paths, then the interference will be such that all the atoms, in principle, show up in one of the output ports. Or if I have a pi phase shift with respect to that 0 and pi, then they're in the other port. This is the idealized situation, which certainly held true for our calibration data, where we separated the atoms by just 1.2 centimeters. When we separated out by 54 centimeters with larger momentum recoil, this is where we had, for the experts, 90 photon recoils worth of momentum. These fluctuations weren't quite as pronounced. We also lose some atoms from the signal due to spontaneous emission and other losses. Yet we still see very strong fluctuations from the two kind of output phase configurations. Now, there's a giant disclaimer here, and that is we didn't deterministically control the phase. The phase of those interfering paths is corrupted by, I shouldn't say corrupted, but it's a function of numerous inputs. One of them being basically the fluctuation in the phase of the laser beams at the point at which they interact with the atomic wave packets. And so this is like there's just a randomly fluctuating phase between for all of the atoms participating in this this measurement, such that we can do a pulse selection and pick out some of the shots where all the atoms show up in one output port and some of the other shots where all the atoms show up in the other output port. And then on this slide, I'm just making an inference. I'm calling this, you know, relative phase of pi, and this is relative phase of zero. Right? Now, you might say, wait a minute, this sounds dodgy. Because, you know, when you get to situations like this where there's allegedly a half meter between the wave packs, they come back together, and you say, well, so the signature for interference is fluctuation at the output port. I can tell you there are a lot of ways of making the signal fluctuate at the output port. And so what is the smoking gun? And so this next slide is really, I think, the smoking gun slide. This is a measurement of the coherence length of the interferometer, showing that as we detune the interferometer from a condition where it's perfectly aligned and the wave packets kind of overlap one on top of the other to one where they don't overlap, we should be able to go from a situation where we see large fluctuations at the output to basically no fluctuations at the output. And so if I plot the fluctuations at the output ports, you know, how much the signal bounces between those two peaks, as a function of the alignment, which is in terms of this is the timing offset of the pulse sequence, then I can basically scan the contrast envelope for that interferometer, just as I would imbalance arms in an optical interferometer and go from the peak of the contrast envelope to off peak and see no interference. And so we do that for various wave packet separations, 50 centimeters, 30 centimeters, 18 centimeters, and measure that width, and then plot that width as a function of the separation. And then there's a very simple theory that relates the temperature of the source to the coherence length, that if you believe quantum mechanics, you have basically a condition for when interference ought to exist. And so this is the simple quantum prediction, and this is our data, which to me this shows sort of unambiguously that we're seeing the quantum interference effect that we had hoped we were seeing when we looked at those fluctuations. Okay, so what do we know now? Well, we know that wave packets separate half meter, come back together, and interfere. What do we learn from that? Here's we go into the mindset that quantum mechanics may not be valid on all spatial or temporal scales. And in particular, ask the question, well, maybe there's something wrong with quantum mechanics when the wave functions of rubidium atoms separate by a half meter. Maybe there's some interactions, in this case, the so-called Ellis model, which was popular back in the 80s, says that there's a sea of, okay, from my experimentalist perspective, I have trouble uttering these words, but there's like a sea of wormholes out there that scatter off the atoms that lead to momentum exchange here, that momentum exchange leads to decoherence. Now, one thing that happens when you separate the wave packets by a half meter is that you become very sensitive to small momentum exchange. Because basically, if you have a delta K from a scattering event, maybe due to wormholes, then you delta K separated by a distance of x leads to a phase shift delta K times x. When x gets big, a half meter, you become very sensitive to those small delta K. And so from an operational perspective, what we're doing is placing limits on the residual heating that's allowed to exist through these this unknown but possibly correct momentum exchange mechanism. So this Ellis model predicts that wormholes are doing that, and then you can set limits on some of the parameters there. And it turns out that our experiment was used in this paper to show that there's the archive version that's published in PRA, that for the parameters initially proposed by Ellis, said, okay, it's good to know the world is not comprised by this gas of wormholes. Here's an interesting one. So there's another theory out there. Maybe gravity itself, the gravitation of the Earth, is there kind of acting as a which path meter for the atoms. All right, so when the atoms are separated by 54 centimeters, there's a very different gravitational interaction at this location as at that location. And you can go and calculate some parameters and so forth. And it's different enough that due to the presence of the Earth's gravitational gradient, there is a large enough phase shift that you might believe that gravity somehow collapsed the wave function at one location or another location. Now, the theory that does that is known in the literature as the KTM model. And I note that on this paper, there are several people from this neck of the woods on it. And our experiment turns out to constrain this KTM model very effectively. I'll come back to some other data later in the talk, but kind of what this is saying, and I'm not saying I believe it or even know how I would construct a theory that does this, but somehow when I have a quantum wave packet that's separated by a large distance, maybe there's a way that gravity somehow can't take on the superposition of values of forces that's required to allow this coherent interaction to exist. And so somehow there is something traced in the environment that is going to obliterate that coherence.
Say with the fluctuation dissipation theorem here that this mechanism does not dissipate. This theory, if it just has to do with the gravitational potential, it's conservative. I go up and I come back down, and I haven't done any dissipation. I don't think it's going to destroy the wave packet general grounds.
Excellent. So, in fact, the fluctuation dissipation theorem, if you go and read this paper, features into that. So there are a set of fluctuations that have to exist that are kind of microscopically leading to the random phase shift that obliterates the coherence. And that can be also described in terms of a dissipative term in the equations of motion. So I refer you to this paper. So it's all there.
But if I'm saying it isn't dissipative.
Well, and I'm saying you have a very naive view of gravity. That's the mindset you have to be in for this. Okay,
so I get it.
It's alternate reality.
So take, for example, if you had some gas of very light particles going around, and one of them banged off this thing and went in another direction, that would destroy the coherence, even if it didn't disturb the motion of this other thing, right? I mean, a photon can bounce off a mirror.
I'm saying the gravitational potential itself can't do it.
Oh yeah, well
no. No, you have to go. Right, so there's the gravitational potential from your perspective now is this odd machine that for every experiment you do, because you work with these giant masses, looks like the classical potential you know and love. But for our system, where we have wave packets delocalized over a half meter, there's a noise source in that you're blind to, but the atoms separated by a half meter are not blind to, that through fluctuation dissipation, it's all in there, will lead to loss of coherence. And it's interesting when you go and look at the size of this effect, and this was not understood until this preprint, that your standard thinking is that you're going to do better with larger masses, both as a source mass and as the proof mass. And this is leading a lot of people in the kind of cavity optomechanics, these beautiful systems that Andy described to us, say, well, maybe we should be doing these tests with large cantilevers and so forth, because that jacks up that value of m way above a single atom's mass. However, what makes it particularly promising to be working with these atomic wave packets is that delta x, the separation between the wave packets, is dramatically larger than you can achieve in the optomechanical systems. And so when you do all the math, it turns out that the decoherence rates for the so-called KTM model are really fast for this half meter separation, so fast that if this was true, we would have lost coherence. We didn't lose coherence, so you gotta say KTM is probably not a valid way of thinking about nature. And if you're interested, here are some of the other dephasing rates for different systems, large molecule interferometry. Unbelievably, you can diffract algae off gratings, things like that. If you're an expert in this area, you also know about Deossi-Penrose. It was thought that Deossi-Penrose mechanism was equivalent to KTM a couple of years ago until this paper came along. Until 6 months ago. And it turns out Deossi-Penrose and KTM test different aspects of gravity, and we are nowhere near being able to test a kind of Penrose-type mechanism for this. I just gave you an example of two specific models. Somebody invents crazy theory and then does phenomenology, and then our data constrains it or not. There are general frameworks out there. This is known as the so-called macroscopicity framework, coming out of Vienna group, Nimrichter and Hornberger, published in 2013, that sort of tried to take a more generic look at maybe a phenomenological level of all the different possible ways that quantum mechanics could break down. And so they concocted this these parameters, one known as kind of macroscopicity. When I go into their literature, basically what they're doing is trying to provide a framework that talks about a large class of theories under one umbrella. And that class of theories are the continuous spontaneous localization theories. Namely, I have quantum superposition state propagating through space-time. There's some, you know, additional quantum magic out there that is providing a momentum transfer and noise such that coherence is ultimately obliterated in an interference experiment, or superposition is, quote, lost. And so they parameterize their theory. Yeah?
For photons, over how long separations has quantum superposition been tested?
Yeah, well, I think LIGO is a pretty good example. Although, you know, last time I got that question, I said that, and I don't know if this is going to be well received. This, I just, you know, photons and atoms, just, I'm an experimentalist, so I work at very low level. They just seem very different to me. Okay, photon is something that can be described by a classical field, you know, and I don't necessarily want to talk about photons in the same way I talk about atoms in these interferometric measurements. But if you wanted to provide a common framework, then I think the LIGO interferometer's got to be, you know, the most awesome photon interference experiment. Interesting, in the literature, the kind of guys who are writing these CSL theories and so on are somewhat, some of them are, well, there's been a very recent paper from Bossi, which is willing to put photons and atoms on equivalent ground or massive particles. But some of the earlier, a lot of the earlier work wanted to draw a sharp distinction. What do I know? So basically, in terms of these continuous spontaneous localization theories, think of them what you may. This has been a cottage industry for two decades. When I read what's, I don't really understand how the world could be as they describe in those papers, but it's nonetheless, sometimes it's useful to have these phenomenological frameworks to compare various experiments. And so this is the length scale over which the interference is occurring, and we do a very good job at the large length scales. And this is basically a parameter that describes the amount of coherence. And so, you know, our work at the larger length scales, with certain caveats that were pointed out to us by some of our colleagues at Berkeley, do a good job at constraining classes of these experiments. Okay, so I've only been talking about, you know, what it takes to have coherence exist. And now let's. Of course, when you build an interferometer from a measurement perspective, you're looking forward to the day when you can basically use the measured phase shift as a way of learning something about the world. And so let's talk a little bit about the phase shift that you observe under these parameter conditions. And so needless to say, there's a well-defined way of integrating the Schrödinger equation to learn the phase shift. And here, this is Kontanuji wrote, I think, the best intro description of this back in 1994, just after some of the pioneering experiments came out. And basically, to calculate the phase shift, you do what you'd expect you needed to do. As you're tracing the wave packets through the interferometer, you have to basically integrate over the number of de Broglie waves of one arm with respect to the other arm, and that gives you a phase shift. You also have two more shifts that are peculiar to, one is definitely peculiar to the type of interferometry we do. Light pulse interferometry involves the interaction of an optical field with the atomic wave packet. Every time that field is kicked on, you read in the phase of the optical field to the atomic coherence, so we call that the laser field shift. And then finally, the interferometer may be misaligned so that one wave packet isn't exactly overlapped with the second wave packet. And in this kind of Feynman path integral way of thinking about the world or the situation, we also have to account for that misalignment. We call that the wave packet separation shift. Needless to say, you put all these, you have your Hamiltonian, something that determines the semi-classical trajectories of the wave packet, you put it into your calculation machinery, and you can calculate the phase shifts. Let me show you some phase shifts. So you can, we affectionately refer to these as, quote, term lists. And with numerical algebra packages, these term lists can have hundreds of terms, literally, depending on how you parameterize the Hamiltonian. You have rotations. You have gravitational gradients. You have magnetic fields. You have gradients of magnetic fields. You have the kitchen sink, in principle. You have new physics that you could put into these. And I'm just looking at a small subset of them. So let's look at the top one there, acceleration due to gravity. Well, that turns out to be an enormous phase shift, nearly 10 to the 10 radians of phase, one arm with respect to the other arm, evolve before the wave packets come back together and interfere. Right? So in order to see that interference, it's just like somehow, you know, we are maintaining coherence over that dramatically large offset. Now there's some, you know, here's Coriolis forces. This is some of the timing asymmetry stuff. This term here looks pretty interesting. You know, a lot of the other terms here don't involve, embarrassingly, Planck's constant. Here's a term, and I'm doing quantum interferometry. Like, where's the Planck's constant in some of these expressions? Well, this one here actually involves, it's an interesting combination between Planck's constant, the mass of the interfering particle, a gravitational gradient. This term actually is related to the decoherence mechanism that was in the KTM model. But now the mindset is gravity is just that classical potential that you know and love is not going to do anything stupid to you. And so all it will do is give a relative phase between the interfering wave packets. In the literature, it's been known for nearly a decade, affectionately as a quantum curvature phase shift. And it's been known before that under other auspices. And so we looked at that term and said, like, hey, you know, there have been experiments that measured that one. People have built gyros based on that one. This is how we did our coherence measurements. Can we isolate that term? And so we devised the following interferometry topology, which is slightly different from what I just showed you. Jason also showed you this earlier. Again, I'm in a frame that's co-falling with the atoms, and I'm tracing out the position of the center of mass of the atomic wave packets. And basically what we do is we arrange a chain of optical pulses to take the initial ensemble, split that ensemble in two, and then build one interferometer up here and another interferometer down there. And what each of these interferometers is doing is measuring the local gravitational environment as seen by the wave packets separated by this distance, which can be quite large. I think in these experiments, it was, well, this diagram is for 12 centimeters. What I showed you previously, we had the half meter. But what's interesting here is I can compare the output of this phase shift to this phase shift. And what this kind of experimentally allows me to do is get rid of some of these other nasty phase fluctuations that were otherwise kind of obliterating my ability to get information out of phase at all. And so now what I want to do is by comparing phase shift of this interferometer and this interferometer, I want to see if I can learn about the gravitational curvature and how that infects the phase shift on the de Broglie waves. And one of my theory friends said, when you have nothing to say, say it in color. And I have a new, I have a corollary to that. If you have something in color, it's always better to say it in Blender. If some of you are familiar with this rendering package that makes data look almost like it's not data. So this is the Blender rendered version of this is actually real data. And what we're doing is we're measuring the relative phase between this interference pattern and that interference pattern at this location. And that relative phase, it turns out, is sensitive to the differential gravitational gradient between this location and that location. And the resolution here is kind of amazing. In a single shot, we measure at basically better than a tenth of a percent the Earth's gravitational gradient. So I want to isolate that quantum curvature shift. Here's how we do it. We take a stack of lead bricks. It's like seven lead bricks. And we bring it close to the pair of interferometers. Here's one of the interferometers. This is the upper arm and the lower arm of this interferometer, and then simultaneously there was this other interferometer, upper arm and lower arm. They're flying by this lead, and that lead is reading in via gravitational interaction, a phase shift here and a phase shift there. And just to show you on a space diagram, time diagram, how this is working, this is the space-time diagram representing now, not in the falling frame, but in the laboratory frame, the positions of the wave packets as a function of time for each of the interferometers. And then this is a diagram that shows you the gravitational acceleration introduced on the... By the way, I could have even better than zeptonewtons if I was willing to, you know, have the mass of the atom in this. But here we have the acceleration introduced by the lead, and as a function of the height. And you see that this interferometer sees a very different gravitational gradient than that interferometer. So by comparing the phase shift associated with this interferometer and that interferometer, assuming that all those other terms in the term list are basically rejecting as a common mode, I have a way of isolating that quantum curvature shift. And so this is the data. This is basically the data showing that that's what's happening. I can modulate the position of these lead bricks, measure the differential phase shift between the upper and lower interferometers. That's what you see here quite clearly happening. As the bricks are out, I have one phase shift. When they're moved in, they have a different phase shift. I can do this as a function of the height of these trajectories with respect to the lead bricks. I have excellent experimental controls on this, and then I can go and compare with theory. And so the neat thing is, when you compare with theory, there's a lot going on in this, and I don't want to explain the subfigure and whatever. I want to basically say that the data that we observe basically directly confirms that quantum curvature term. And the way we isolate that term amongst other tricks from some of the other terms is we change the separation of the wave packets and we look at the observed phase shift. And what you find out is that the phase shift you observe is what you expect. Now you say, like, oh, okay, you're just doing quantum mechanics. I believe gravity to be this classical potential, so maybe there's not much that's significant there. So in the history of the literature that pinpoints this phase shift as being something interesting to measure is the following thought, that in GR, uniform accelerations are just a kinematic effect that I can transform away by appropriate choice of reference frame. If I go to a co-falling reference frame and do a measurement like this, I would expect to see no acceleration due to gravity. However, GR also says that curvature is the fundamental quantity. It doesn't matter which reference frame, if I'm in the accelerating frame, co-accelerating frame, or not, I can't boost away, essentially, the effects of curvature. And so from the mindset of some of these papers, the idea is that, oh, neutron interferometry, some of the early atom interferometries, any particle interferometry that people claimed to be measuring a gravitational effect, a fringe shift from the presence of universal gravity, wasn't making a true test of gravitation, because a true test of gravitation from the relativistic perspective would involve directly measuring the space-time curvature. And so that's what we feel like we're doing here for the first time. And for like the 15 people in the world who have thought about this has kind of been a holy grail. And so we're happy to be part of their holy grail. Yeah.
Just to clarify, so you're claiming you've measured the space-time curvature due to these chunks of lead acting on these things.
Yeah. And what enables us to do that is that the wave packets are separated by 10 centimeters. And that makes it so that we actually have enough sensitivity over that 10-centimeter distance to see the differential acceleration from the lead brick on that single wave. The wave packets are separated by 10 centimeters, but that's a single wave function for a given atom.
How large is the gradient due to the Earth?
Oh, well, gradient due to the Earth is, it's
must
3086 edvosh, which is 3×10⁻¹ g per meter. So it's a relatively small effect. And just to put all these numbers in perspective, the gravitational attraction between two humans sitting a meter apart is about 10⁻⁹ g. So 10⁻⁹ g. So Earth's gravity gradient is 100, basically 100 times larger than that, but it's still compared to the acceleration due to gravity, it's the change in compared to 9.8 meters per second squared is basically a tenth of a part per million of that over a meter scale distance.
But
Are you measuring the Riemann tensor, or are you measuring some scalar?
It's the spatial gradient that they're measuring.
It's the spatial gradient.
The space-time gradient. The space-time gradient is what I measure when I watch something accelerate.
No, oh, sure.
You're measuring the
static
second derivative of the space derivative of the...
Right.
Right. It's not a space-time measurement.
No, there's clearly, if I wanted to go and constrain some of the relativity parameters, I would have to introduce motion. And so that's not happening. But even at this level, this is just the static measurement has been considered something that's been missing from the experimental foundation of, can quantum systems how do quantum systems interfere under the influence of gravity? And before this experiment, you had no notion that you could have the influence of the gravitational gradient on a single quantum wave packet. This traces back to the KTM. You say, well, why do I care about that? Because you might be able to, you might want to concoct a model like the KTM model, which actually didn't let coherence exist over that large distance. I'm not saying I subscribe. My caveat at the beginning of the talk was, put yourself in the mindset that quantum mechanics breaks.
Right. So now here we are in the Newtonian limit. Riemann tensor becomes gravity gradient. So why do you say that you are testing space-time curvature? Why not the Newtonian?
I should say it's Newtonian curvature.
Yeah, it's the same thing, right?
Right. Yeah. Thanks for that comment.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're also just building a good gravity gradiometer, and for a lot of these precision measurements, you need to keep track of what the gravity gradient is doing. So this is some less interesting data that shows that we can measure the gravity gradient of the pit. So with this configuration, I said we have better than a tenth of a percent and a single shot resolution on Earth's gravity gradient. So if I change the launch height of those wave packets from basically 5 meters, where their turning point is here, and compare that to the turning point there, I measure the gravity gradient in this environment. And not surprisingly, we made some attempt to model that's these red dots. This is the kind of theory that you guys all run from. Can you calculate the gravity gradient from the concrete near my apparatus? It's involving integrals and so forth. And so at any rate, we do that. And the reason I have this slide slipped in there is because there are kind of great practical applications for gravity gradiometers. One of them that Jason highlighted is these gravity gradiometers with extended baselines are awesome gravitational wave detectors, we think. If you fly them in low Earth orbit, they make a great ways of characterizing the Earth's gravitational anomaly. And so we're collaborating with people at Goddard Space Flight Center to see just how far we can push a so-called cold atom gravity gradiometer in terms of measuring the Earth's residual gravity anomaly. Now, there are lots of technologies out there that can do a fantastic job, and superconducting gravity gradiometer is also an excellent candidate for a future mission. The so-called GRACE configuration, where I have two satellites that are ranged by microwaves and in the future by lasers, also do well. And so right now, because we've had success with understanding what the first experiments have done, the GRACE mission, for example, in terms of being able to produce these maps, there's interest in increasing the spatial resolution and the sensitivity so you can do things like observe the melting of the Greenland ice sheet and understand where the water table is at various points in the Earth. And so this strikes me as a very significant and applied application. And the topology we demonstrated with this gravity gradient quantum curvature measurement actually feeds very nicely into one of these instruments. And I just want to point out that a prototype of this is being built by Alex Sugarbaker, and this is a picture of his apparatus out at AOSense. I want to finish this segment of the talk by describing what's been a holy grail for us for more than a decade, and I'm literally embarrassed to be describing this experiment in front of Eric, because one, his limits are probably unbeatable, and two, he's been listening to me talk about this for literally a decade. But we are almost there. And so the idea is, instead of having just rubidium 87, have rubidium 85 and 87 at the bottom of this tube, launch them up and down the tube, measure the phase shift simultaneously for both clouds of atoms as they run through the interferometer, compare those phase shifts, and ask the question, is there something beyond the equivalence principle that introduces a differential acceleration between these two isotopes? And so here's some recent data. What the experiment I just described is easier said than done. And so now we have this cartoon shows two ensembles of cold rubidium atoms, 87 and 85, all cooled down to low temperature, launched up, simultaneously seeing a common set of laser fields that does the atom interferometer thing. And then we take pictures at the output port here. And we have the rubidium 85 interference fringes. This is one port of the 85 interferometer and the other. And then we adjust the timing so that the 87 is snugged in beneath it. This is the 87 port. This is the cartoon. This is some real data. And what we're doing now is, in addition to looking at the systematics, which are plenty, just taking ensembles of shots. Each shot takes about 20 seconds. And for every shot, you see a position of interference fringes between 85 and 87. They're fluctuating randomly because there are these random terms that I talked about earlier. But one thing to note is that if you look at the peak of one of these interference fringes and compare it to the peak of the 85 and the 87, they're always correlated. And so we're looking at the correlations between those fluctuations. It's, you know, you have to be a little zen here. But they're fluctuating around like this. And by looking at the differential phases and integrating, you and taking account of systematics, you learn about the equivalence principle. And our target precision here is 10 to the minus 14. The data we have in terms of the statistical sensitivity supports that. And we're looking at, we have systematics which are substantially above that, I would say, in the 10 to the minus 12 level right now that we're unwinding. So how am I doing in time?
Another 20 minutes.
Oh, excellent. OK. So we will get to dinner. I want to turn the page now. And I've just been describing tests of quantum mechanics where we've been exploiting the idea that I can take a single wave packet of rubidium 87 and separate it over a half a meter and bring it back and ask the question, what does that tell us about? And the quantum mechanics. And I've also been telling you about some of the applications, both for fundamental science, e.g. equivalence principle, and technology measuring terrestrial gravity gradients. Now I want to push on a different macroscopic parameter. I want to talk about creating correlated ensembles of atoms with quantum measurement techniques that operationally will improve the precision of the interferometers and from tests of quantum mechanics give us a kind of new ways of thinking about a massively entangled system. And so the kind of the applied perspective here is that if you have an atomic spin sensor that's limited by spin noise, you're limited by the number of atoms that you can process in any given experimental shot, and that's limiting the precision of the sensor. And you really have very few ways of increasing that atom number due to technical reasons. The atoms start colliding with one another and so forth. And that if you want to improve precision, your only real strategy is to exploit quantum entanglement to reduce shot noise, that square root of n noise term, which is so hard to explain. So just to make this point in a different way, if I build an interferometric sensor and scan the phase, and I'm limited by the Poissonian statistics of wave function collapse at the output ports, then it's well known that at a fixed phase, when I have the finite number of atoms going into the interferometer, I have a spread in measurement outcomes. And fundamentally, I would say that this is for quantum systems, it's if you say, well, why is that there? And it's because of the randomness of wave function collapse. And so you could say, is there a strategy whereby I can correlate the particles in order to get around that noise? And so this is a line of thought that goes originated in the gravitational wave detection community and has been around for nearly 30 years. It's like, yes. The word that people use is, quote, squeeze states. And the fancy way of talking about that these days is as entangled states. And so let me show you an experiment we did where the design of the experiment was to mitigate this noise source, shot noise. But And I think going into that experiment, I wasn't convinced that there was much anything deep in terms of looking at quantum mechanics other than the fact that I could engineer it to get around shot noise. But I think now when I enter the mindset of like maybe quantum mechanics breaks, what's going on here is absolutely fascinating. So let me tell you the story. First, I'll cut to our punchline data. So if I take an ensemble of two-level systems, I prepare it in ground state, and then I prepare each and every atom with a pi over 2 pulse in a superposition of ground and excited state, and then I make a projective measurement, and I look at the measurement outcomes, then as a function of what I measure is the number of atoms in one of the states versus the other state of an ensemble of close to 1 million atoms so prepared, I observe, if I don't do anything fancy, a shot noise statistics and a distribution which for our particular system parameters is shown in blue. This is just the assuming no known correlations between atoms in various points in the ensemble. These are the statistics of shot noise. Now, if I do something fancy, and I'll tell you what that is on the next slide, and I create the appropriate entanglement or squeezing, what I can do is manipulate the variance of that distribution. And it stands to reason that if I can make that distribution narrower, I can reduce the readout noise of the sensor if I can also preserve coherence. And so I'll show you that that's what we've done here. This slide just shows you that with the appropriate quantum non-demolition measurement, I am able to narrow that distribution. And this is for one set of experimental parameters. Just to show you that I can use this in a real measurement, I have manipulated the parameters between the red and the orange here such that I've introduced a coherent phase shift between the atoms and the distribution, showing that I can resolve very small phase shifts. There's a lot of talk that entanglement's going to do good for the world. And I think this is one of the signal noise we obtain with this apparatus and this measurement is the best signal noise that you can achieve via any method. So if I say, use all your laser cooling tricks and go and do everything you want to build an atomic clock, what's the best readout signal noise you can have? Basically, you can have 2 to 3,000 to 1 in a given shot. And that's something a number that's out there in the literature over the past decade. If I do this entanglement operation, I can beat that. And so here's where I think, okay, entanglement is delivering here more than just, as Giorgio referred to earlier, it's more than just a PubLon, the minimum publishable unit. So how do we do it? Well, what we do is we make a non-destructive measurement of the number of atoms in a cavity mode, and essentially measure the atoms. Each atom in this apparatus behaves as a little piece of index of refraction. And I count the number of atoms non-destructively in that mode by looking at the effect of putting that index of refraction into a high-finesse optical cavity. So here's the high-finesse optical cavity. Here are the atoms. When the atoms are in there, it shifts the resonance frequency, and with a homodyne readout and some balance detections and details I don't want to go into, we can very precisely measure the change in the resonance frequency of the cavity, and from that slope, basically infer the number of atoms that are in the cavity mode. And it just so happens that using this dispersive interaction strategy, it really is non-destructive. Like when I put each of those atoms in a coherent superposition state between lower state and upper state, ground and excited, and then go in with this dispersive interaction and try and count the number of atoms in the excited state, I can do that, and I can preserve the coherence of that interaction, which means I can come in with another pi over 2 pulse, I can make a clock, I can build an interferometer, and yet I can still also reduce the counting statistics at the output port. So that's an experimental detail. That's the experimental apparatus. Let me say a little bit more. So the cold atoms start there. They get loaded into this high-finesse cavity. There's a laser beam that probes the number of atoms non-destructively in the cavity mode along this axis. We use the balanced homodyne readout, which is optimal for this, turns out is optimal for this type of measurement. And in the end, we prepare that squeeze state distribution, and then this is the data that shows that this is useful. In addition to preparing the squeeze state, we also show that we have full coherence with that ensemble. So I can come in, after I've made the squeeze state, I can do rotations of that state on the Bloch sphere or use a microwave interactions to show that I can still have an interferometric output here. Now, this is just like the cartoon I showed you at the first slide of this segment of the talk. And so if I were to sit there and look at the fluctuations in the signal at that point and use that to infer the phase, what I have won here is that those fluctuations have been reduced by a factor 10 over what they used to be. And turns out you can take this method and apply it to a precision measurement. Like here we built an atomic clock. And this is basically a kind of an atomic clock picture of showing the noise is reduced. When you want to do this from the clock community, you plot the fractional stability of your frequency reference as a function of the averaging time of the clock. And if I don't do squeezing tricks, I get this line. If I do the squeezing tricks, I get this line. And down is an improvement over the so-called shot noise limit. This should have been 20 dB. We only had 10 dB, and we were limited by some technical fluctuations in our microwave system. OK, so this is a perspective that maybe this squeezing is going to be good for sensors. But let's ask the perspective, let's adopt the perspective of what does it tell us about quantum mechanics? All right, first, I say that there's entanglement going on. How much entanglement is in this system? All right, we don't really have a good way of going and looking at the full density matrix of this system. After all, there's close to 1 million atoms, and only subsets of the atoms are entangled or correlated in such a way that the noise is reduced. So how can we get at this? Well, there's been a growing body of theoretical literature that basically uses the experimental observables, which for us are the noise along the z-axis of the Bloch sphere, what the variance fluctuations were, and the coherence. And by measuring those two numbers, you can make inferences, doing a lot of theory, about what the so-called entanglement depth of this system is. And it turns out the entanglement depth is pretty large. Like, there are non-factorizable parts of this wave function, by inference, that contain ensembles of, like, on the order of 1,000 atoms. So there's a lot of entanglement in these clusters that's the engine for these statistics.
Out of a million, only 1,000 are entangled?
Only 1,000, Savas. Now, let me tell you how perverse that is. Let me just put those million atoms on this table here. And, well, okay, let me go with the system where 1,000 atoms are, you know, a full 1,000 atoms are entangled. I've got a full 1,000 atoms on the entanglement. Now I go and do, let's go measure that ensemble. And I measure this one up here. That's a spin up. I measure this one here. That's a spin down. I measure this one here, over here. It's a spin up. And I measure over all those 1,000. And somehow, you may not be amazed by this, but I am totally blown away that the world is such that when I add up the total numbers of spin up and spin down, that they all know about each other. Even when I do a projective measurement across this entire ensemble, I could do this one first, and then that one, and that one, and that one. And at the end of the day, I get this reduction in noise variance. How is it that the physical world is structured in such a way that across that entire ensemble, they all seem to know about each other?
So does this mean 1,000 atoms are in the equatorial Dickey state?
So the situation I just described to you, that's an idealized situation. It's more complicated than that because the entanglement depth, I have 1 million atoms and only 1,000 of them are in these entangled states. So there's a density matrix that you would really need to use to describe what's going on. Just to show you how, so this is something that took us by surprise. So analysis came out in 2016 that said somebody did a squeezing experiment and said, you know, let's talk about how we characterize that state. I can talk about it in terms of entanglement depth. I can talk it about in terms of variance reduction. Turns out there are Bell correlations in that state. And so you can construct a quantity. We don't go and measure, do a bunch of Bell experiments in parallel. We can't do that. But you can construct a so-called witness that tells you about the amount of Bell correlations in that system and do some experimental, there's some experimental knobs you use to characterize this Bell witness. And basically, just like with the Bell inequality, when you go bigger than 2, that shows you that you're in a quantum mechanical regime. If the witness goes below 0 here, then that's quantum mechanics is at work. And so the signal noise on this witness, it's more than almost a 60 sigma of violation of the kind of the classical boundary. And in some of the configurations we observed, that Bell witness was more than 100 sigma below, you know, what if the system was classically behaving, it should be. It's not surprising. We know quantum mechanics is at play there. But what this is showing is that there's a particular type of correlation that's just due to Bell inequality. I'd really like to know what's actually going on in that experiment and what the actual wave function is and why nature is letting that happen. There's no good test theory out there for you that how quantum mechanics might tell you something otherwise. It's just been assumed in this literature that quantum mechanics is there, it's going to be good, and this is its outcome.
Do you even know which parameters increase the entanglement or decrease it?
Oh, we do know that. Yeah, so in terms of the macroscopic parameters, you can read that off here. So you want to go higher coherence, and you want to go lower fluctuations. And so the limit is an equatorial Dickey state where the full ensemble is, and we're still 40 dB away from that one. Yeah. So there's lots of room to grow. So I'm at my conclusion here. I say, well, where's the future lie? And from this quantum mechanics test perspective, what we'd like to do is to create these massively entangled ensembles of atoms and now spatially separate them over half meter scales and ask, understand whether that's actually going to give us a signal noise enhancement for gravitational measurements, or will we explore some sort of decoherence that was unexpected. And this is some data that's basically showing that we're starting down that path. And because it's time for dinner, these are the people who contributed to this work. Thanks for your attention.
Can you talk a bit about the systematics that are keeping you from publishing the...
We have a list. We have our term list. And some of the things, one of the more troubling systematics is gravitational gradients, which explains our focus on, this is for equivalence principle, our focus on gravity gradients.
That's where you got the...
Characterizing them and developing strategies to mitigate them. So if the position of the atom cloud shifts by just a number of nanometers, if you don't have a trick, that will be enough to lead you to an apparent violation of the equivalence principle. So you need excellent spatial control over the center mass positions of the wave packets. And put it another way, you might want a trick that helps mitigate that sensitivity. And so there's been some excellent ideas coming out of the Hanover group, which we're exploring right now, which seem very promising. Basically completely taking the systematic off the table. So that's been, our dominant problem source. We have Well, it's one of these, it's a trick. So it's hard to, you have to go and shift the wavelength of one of the lasers at one of the points in the interaction sequence. And it basically has a way of reducing the sensitivity gravitational gradients. It's sort of like a golden wavelength. Seriously, yeah.
That was lovely. Could you explain again what's the mechanism for entangling these 1,000 atoms? What is it that does it? I need to hear it again.
What does the magic is the atom, the non-demolition atom cavity interaction, where I put the ensemble of atoms in a particular quantum state, which I prepare by atoms initially in ground state, then a microwave pi over 2 pulse, so that each and every atom is a coherent superposition of ground and excited state. That's one that if I were to do a projective measurement at that point in time, I would get the standard shot noise distribution. Now I say, maybe I could come in and non-destructively measure the number of atoms in the excited state. And I do this with this dispersive cavity interaction that basically is measuring the number of atoms in the excited state. When I come in with that probe, what it does is it collapses the wave function into one of these particular combinations that of number of atoms in the excited state and the ground state by virtue of the phase shift that I observe in that probe beam. And so, in a sense, the interaction entangles the statistics of the atom distribution with the light field, and then I make a destructive measurement on the light field that then projects the atoms into a particular squeezed state. And so, when that happens, what's nearly miraculous is that after that projection, under the appropriate parameter regimes, we retain nearly full coherence in the ensemble that's left in the cavity, so that I can come and do subsequent microwave rotations and benefit from the fact that I have now measured the distribution noise fluctuations to a level below the shot noise limit, but yet have not disturbed my sensitivity to coherent interactions. Now, how does that entanglement happen? I don't have a good answer to that question.
You are scattering all the phase information away and just preserving the number.
Yeah.
So you can adjust the amplitude, so you're squeezing in phase. Yeah.
Right. We're making a projective measurement, and that's localizing the state to that value. But
phase is not relevant, so yeah, that's right.
So if you imagine there are waterfalls which scatter off these atoms or something like that, then if the coherence length of the home pulse is long enough that they would scatter from the whole wave packet, then wouldn't it kind of give you the same variance behavior as you see? So you wouldn't be able to tell if they scatter from all atoms coherently.
Right. Yeah, so this is for the squeezing data. Yeah, and so...
Well, this is from the very beginning of your talk, where you talked about the 54.
Okay, so and now what... Oh, so
if there's some gravitational or quantum mechanics effect, which relies on this 54 centimeter separation, but it also has to scatter incoherently from each atom to see a signal.
Yeah.
If it comes coherently from all the atoms in the wave packet, it would look the same.
That's right. Oh, correct. So there's some theories that you could have a residual interaction that scatters coherently off all the atoms, and therefore I would just see a randomization of the phase shift. And so to lose coherence, it has to basically inhomogeneously scatter across the ensemble. And so there are only some theories that satisfy that criteria. So the KTM is one of them. The Ellis model is another one. There's other theories. Some of the CSL theories, the spontaneous localization theories, behave coherently across the ensemble, and therefore they're not testable with that experiment. You would need to look at phase noise at the outputs. So it really, you have to look at the details of the theory, which is why I don't like that phenomenological framework, because a lot gets swept under the rug.
I'm curious, for some of the sensor applications, like the gravity gradients, do you know what either the accuracy is of those measurements, or alternatively, the very long-term stability? I mean, stability if you want to.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and exactly the question to ask for these space-based systems, because you want to have accuracy over the many orbital periods. So we've built proof of concept instruments in the past that have shown exceptional accuracy over timescales of as long as 10 to the 5 seconds. Basically, the noise output of those just integrates down as white over that time period. For the highest sensitivity configurations, we haven't demonstrated that yet. So that's what that apparatus at AOSense is going to be doing, is showing that you can get high precision output that also maintains accuracy over suitably long
measurements. So that's building like two identical versions, comparing them over 10 to the 5 minutes.
Or looking at a proof mass whose position is modulated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, then that's
all we have. All right, thank you.